Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The 2020 election in Delaware is in the books, and unlike the national landscape, things here went largely as expected, though the addition of mail-in voting and a huge turnout did add some wrinkles to the story here in the first state. To break down what we saw in the results and what it means going forward, we turn to Delaware State News political reporter Matt Biddle, who joined me earlier this week to dissect election 2020 in Delaware. I'm going to start with this. I mean, you know, the great NFL coach Bill Parcells once said, "You are what your record says you are." And in Delaware, I feel like it seems we know what the record is these days. It seems like, you know, in the primary, the GOP gets pushed to the right a bit. Then in the general, it loses statewide races, with a few exceptions, by this kind of 60-40, 58-42-ish margin. And that's kind of played out for a few cycles, again, with a few exceptions, Page and Ken Simpler. Is it fair to say that the state, at least on the statewide level, is kind of locked into this?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, the Trump brand of Republicanism has its appeal, but, you know, it really is kind of limited. Delaware is pretty much a solidly blue state, I think. You know, once you get down to Sussex, Sussex is pretty much a deep red, but Newcastle completely counteracts that. Newcastle has almost 60% of the state population, and that is a dark blue. There are only two of the legislative districts above the C&D Canal, which is kind of the traditional dividing line for upstate and downstate.
Right.
Only two of the two dozen or so legislative districts there are now held by Republicans. So, yeah, it certainly seems to be locked in as a safe Democratic state for the foreseeable future.
I do want to talk about those legislative seats in a little bit, but I want to stick with the statewide stuff for just a minute and talk a little bit about what you talked about, this kind of like, you know, there is this kind of deep red Sussex County, which in this particular cycle was kind of represented by specifically Lauren Witzke in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Senate race. And I know the News Journal had a piece out this week, you know, kind of asking the question, you know, is Delaware maybe not, you know, aware, you know, experts and media and others aware of just how much this Witzke message is resonating? And I kind of took a deeper dive into the numbers because we talked about this kind of 60-40 split, and she lost, you know, by that kind of same margin.
Sure.
But I was interested, and I looked into the numbers a little bit deeper on the county level and looked at specifically Sussex and Kent, which would be where you would suspect that she would, you know, she would have stronger support and her message mm-hmm. would resonate. And in Sussex County, Witzke defeated Coons with 54.6% of the vote here in 2020. And if you go back to Coons' last race against Kevin Wade in 2014, Wade beat Coons with 56% of the vote. So a slightly higher, but, you know, probably if you're looking at statistically, not really significantly different.
Mm-hmm.
In Kent County, in 2020, Coons, just the other night, won with 53.2% of the vote. In 2014, Wade won Kent County with 50.3% of the vote. And then if you even go back to 2018, which is the Carper-Arlette race, which you could actually say is probably a little bit more of an apples-to-apples comparison because Arlette's very much like Witzke, a very Trump person's closer in time mm-hmm. to this election. In Sussex, we said, you know, Witzke beat Coons with 54.6%. In 2018, Arlette won with 55.3%, slightly better than Witzke. And in Kent County, you know, again, Coons was the winner, 53.2. 2018, Carper won with 53.5. Again, virtually the same. You know, having, you know, kind of digested all those numbers, is it fair to say that while Lauren Witzke has a big presence social media-wise and such, that she's not really making a big dent in what's actually happening politically in this state?
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. I think that there's a little bit of an echo chamber, if you will, down in Sussex. You know, it's so Republican. I think there's kind of a sense that the rest of the state may feel, you know, that way, whether it be about coronavirus or whatever, and that's not really the case. You know, the fact that Witzke ended up getting only about 38%, and as you said, she only won Sussex County is interesting. I know there were, let's see, about 2.5% of the votes in that race went to independents, which
right.
is slightly more than the others. So
right.
maybe some of those were Republicans who just couldn't bring themselves to vote for her. You know, it's hard to say, obviously.
Right.
But, yeah, it does seem that as much as that is, you know, she draws some attention, a lot of attention, and certainly has strong Republican support, it's just hard to see someone like that bringing substantial backing from the other side.
Yeah.
You mentioned Ken Simpler. When he won in 2014, he became the first non-incumbent Republican to win statewide in, I believe, 20 years.
Yep.
And he did that by, you know, winning pretty handily in Kent, Sussex, and keeping it close in Newcastle. So he was, you know, a moderate Republican, and he was able to bring in a lot of Democratic and independent support. And it's hard to see how a Republican can win statewide not running on a moderate platform. And, you know, even then, they'd probably need some kind of help, maybe a scandal with the Democrats or something.
Right. Yeah, and I'm curious because, I mean, like, and what we see with a lot of these candidates on the GOP side, they're kind of one and doneers. I mean, even going back to Christine O'Donnell, you know, she didn't run again. You know, Kevin Wade didn't run again. Hans Riegel, who ran in the House last election cycle, you haven't seen him. You know, I guess I'm curious, you know, do we see a Lauren Witzke or maybe a Julianne Murray run again? Or will once again the Republicans look for somebody else? And I know part of that equation may be we're hearing some reports that Lauren Witzke is more interested in the GOP party chairmanship than maybe running again.
Yeah, it's I wouldn't be surprised if none of the nominees ended up running again. It just kind of, you know, I mean, for one thing, I think they've sort of hit their ceiling. You know, they ran and they didn't do too great for the most part. That 40% pretty much the ceiling right now.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, if you look back, you generally see different candidates running, some repeats certainly from cycle to cycle, but I think the party will probably go with different people, if only to try something new. You know, the unknown, at least there's the potential there perhaps for success. So,
and I guess the question then becomes really, maybe the party chair job in the GOP becomes maybe the more important quote unquote election, because if you keep, say, a Jane Brady or someone like her, maybe there's still room to bring in a moderate, Ken Simpler-esque candidate. If a Lauren Witzke winds up being the party chair for the GOP, I would assume we're looking at candidates like Witzke, like Rob Arlett instead, and their chances of making inroads, you know, in statewide races would be decreased.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's probably for the best for the Republican Party to have someone like Jane Brady, someone who has won elected office before, who's certainly more moderate than Witzke, you know, just in terms of drawing in support from the moderate Republicans, you know, getting support from independents, maybe even some Democrats in some instances. And I think that someone like Jane Brady would be better for fundraising. Witzke, you know, just to continue using her sort of as an example, an archetype. She is, you know, able to bring in some money from, you know, the fervent Trump crowd and whatnot. But in terms of getting the serious donors, I think Jane Brady, that's something that the people like her would be much better at. And having said that, the Republican fundraising base has certainly changed compared to 20 years ago. The 2010 primary really fractured the party. And in some ways, it's still never exactly recovered from that in terms of fundraising and big donors.
So we talked a lot about the Republicans so far. Let's talk a little bit about the Democrats. You know, how do they feel locally post-election day? We'll leave the presidential race on the sidelines for now. They did flip the two state Senate seats that they were looking to get and grabbed a supermajority in the Senate. But they struck out in those House seats that you kind of talked about earlier north of the canal. Is that good enough for the Democrats in this election cycle, considering how everything played out?
I would say so. I think they are definitely disappointed not to get at least one of those House seats. Frankly, I can say I'm surprised that Mike Ramone was able to hang on and win. Everything I was hearing indicated that he was probably done. And he actually won by a little bit of a bigger margin than two years ago. So he obviously is doing something right there. But I think the Democrats are, you know, happy to have those two Senate seats, the supermajority, as you said. So, you know, in theory, they could pass tax increases without any Republican votes, although getting every Democrat on board can be hard enough, certainly. So that's far from a certainty. But I think it's generally a pretty celebratory mood for Democrats looking at the state level and the local races and whatnot here.
And I guess, you know, one of the things that Democrats were touting is that, you know, they've really added youth and diversity. And we talked about this on election night to the General Assembly. Certainly it starts with a Sarah McBride, the first openly transgender person to win a state Senate seat anywhere in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And there are others as well. And Governor Carney even noted on election night about, you know, this rise in youth and diversity. But he also noted, I thought was interesting, that they now need the Democrats to come together and govern, which he said is harder than campaigning. Is that the challenge now for Democrats, even with those supermajorities, to find a consensus on what their agenda is going to be?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are definitely some issues that they can really coalesce around. Expanded voting, for instance, you know, access there. But some things such as gun control, I think that's still going to be, you know, there's still a divide in the caucuses, I think, in terms of getting Democrats on board with something like that. So there's, you know, sort of a push and pull kind of, you know, the left wing, the more moderate wing. Carney, you know, more the moderate Democrat, although at the same time, he's someone who can read the tea leaves, see where things are going. But yeah, it'll definitely be interesting to see how the dynamics play out. You know, with these new members, I'm sure there'll be a push for some progressive legislation that wouldn't have had a chance just a couple of years ago. And, you know, how much of that ultimately ends up succeeding, we'll have to see. The leadership elections in the Senate could end up, you know, having a pretty big role in that.
I do want to go back to kind of the landscape now in the General Assembly. You know, talked about a little bit earlier that, you know, there's still those couple of House seats, you know, north of the canal that are perhaps ones that the Democrats could target in the future. But really, other than those seats, you know, is there any real battlegrounds left in the state that either party could, you know, target and say, hey, we can flip that seat? I mean, if we kind of almost run out of flippable seats at this point?
Yeah, pretty much. It's kind of weird. I don't think it's particularly healthy, quite frankly, having it where it's so polarized, but I think that's pretty much it. For the most part, the districts are kind of locked in for now as either Democrat or Republican. You know, maybe one or two can flip in the future depending on something with the, you know, maybe if the incumbent has a scandal or something. But it's really hard to see, you know, any sort of big change. I think for the most part, you know, Newcastle County, solidly blue. Kent is blue around Dover, and then pretty much everything else in the state going down is blue. I mean, there's only one Democrat in Sussex County, Pete Schwarzkopf, in right. The Rehoboth Beach area. So, yeah, it certainly is. It seems like it's kind of locked in terms of which districts are D and which districts are R.
And I'm wondering if that means it's going to be really hard for the Republicans to recruit candidates like an Anthony Del Colo in Newcastle County, where they're now flying into the headwinds of both registration and as we talked about earlier, kind of the top of the ticket that tends to be more Sussex and conservative than, you know, moderate. Is it going to be hard to get those type of candidates to even bother to run?
Yeah, I think that can definitely be a challenge. I'm sure there are, you know, potential candidates who will see what happened to Del Colo. You know, he was a one-termer. He was certainly one of the more moderate Republicans, not really in the Witski mold. And, you know, he lost. Kathy Cloutier had been there for 22 years in the legislature, another moderate Republican. She lost. So it certainly could be difficult to see the party really getting quality candidates or candidates who can, you know, have a realistic chance of winning in a lot of those districts. I should note that redistricting is coming up.
Right.
I believe it'll be in place for the 2022 election. So, you know, who knows how that could throw a wrench into things. With Democrats in control of the legislature, they can draw it a little bit. So, you know, maybe pick up an additional seat or two for themselves there. But yeah, as we've said, it's pretty much set for the foreseeable future, I think, in terms of which districts are, you know, which affiliation.
Thanks to Delaware State News political reporter Matt Biddle for his time this week. You can find his reporting on state politics anytime at DelawareStateNews.net. And stay with us. The Green continues in a moment with a look at one group's efforts to implement statewide COVID-19 testing and contact tracing in First Aid schools. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media.